7. In the highly moral society of 2114 AD, the weekly block meetings operated on the stagger system. Wardens from surrounding housing units were able to sit at each, forming a board of which the indigenous warden was chairman. Since Mrs. Birmingham was the warden in the Purcell's block, she, of the assembled middle-aged ladies, occupied the raised seat. Her compatriots, in flowered silk dresses, filled chairs on each side of her across the platform.
"I hate this room,"
Janet said, pausing at the door. Alan did too. Down here on the first level of the housing unit, in this one large chamber, all the local leagues, committees, clubs, boards, associations, and orders met. The room smelled of stale sunlight, dust, and the infinite layers of paperwork that had piled up over the years. Here, official nosing and snooping originated. In this room, a man's business was everybody's business. Centuries of Christian confessional culminated when the block assembled to explore its members' souls. As always, there were more people than space. Many had to stand, and they filled the corners and aisles. The air conditioning system moaned and reshuffled the cloud of smoke. Alan was always puzzled by the smoke, since nobody seemed to have a cigarette and smoking was forbidden. But there it was. Perhaps it, like the shadow of purifying fire, was an accumulation from the past. His attention fixed itself on the pack of juveniles. They were here, the earwig-like sleuths. Each juvenile was a foot and a half long. The species scuttled close to the ground, or up vertical surfaces, at ferocious speed, and they noticed everything. These juveniles were inactive. The wardens had unlocked the metal hulls and dug out the report tapes. The juveniles remained inert during the meeting, and then they were put back into service. There was something sinister in these metal informers, but there was also something heartening. The juveniles did not accuse. They only reported what they heard and saw. They couldn't color their information, and they couldn't make it up. Since the victim was indicted mechanically, he was safe from hysterical hearsay, from malice and paranoia. But there could be no question of guilt. The evidence was already in. The issue to be settled here was merely the severity of moral lapse. The victim couldn't protest that he had been unjustly accused. All he could protest was his bad luck at having been overheard. On the platform, Mrs. Birmingham held the agenda and looked to see if everybody had arrived. Failure to arrive was in itself a lapse. Apparently, he and Janet completed the group. Mrs. Birmingham signaled, and the meeting began.
"I guess we don't get to sit,"
Janet murmured as the door closed after them. Her face was pinched with anxiety. For her, the weekly block meeting was a catastrophe, which she met with hopelessness and despair. Each week she anticipated denouncement and downfall, but it never came. Years had gone by, and she had still not officially erred. But that only convinced her that doom was saving itself up for one grand spree.
"When they call me," Alan said softly, "you keep your mouth shut. Don't get in on either side. The less said, the better chance I have."
She glared at him with suffering.
"They'll tear you apart. Look at them."
She swept in the whole room.
"They're just waiting to get at somebody.
Most of them are bored and wish they were out." As a matter of fact, several men were reading their morning newspapers.
"So take it easy. If nobody leaps to defend me, it'll die down and maybe I'll get off with a verbal reprimand."
Assuming, of course, that nothing was in about the statue.
"We will first undertake the case of Miss J.E.,
Miss Birmingham stated. Miss J.E. was Julie Eberly, and everybody in the room knew her. Julie had been up time and again, but somehow she managed to hang on to the lease willed her by her family. Scared and wide-eyed, she now mounted the defendant's stage, a young blonde-haired girl with long legs and an intriguing bosom. Today she wore a modest print dress and low-heeled slippers. Her hair was tied back in a girlish knot.
"Miss J.E.,"
Mrs. Birmingham declared,
did willingly and knowingly on the night of October 6, 2114, engage with a man in a vile enterprise.
In most cases, a vile enterprise was sex. Alan half closed his eyes and prepared to endure the session. A shuffling murmur ran through the room. The newspapers were put aside. Apathy dwindled. To Alan, this was the offensive part, the leering need to hear a confession down to the last detail, a need which masqueraded as righteousness. The first question came instantly.
Was this the same man as the other times?
Miss J.E. colored.
Yes,
she admitted.
Weren't you warned? Hadn't you been told in this very room to get yourself home at a decent hour and act like a good girl?
In all probability, that was now a different questioner. The voice was synthetic, issuing from a wall speaker. To preserve the aura of justice, questions were piped through a common channel, broken down and reassembled without characteristic timbre. The result was an impersonal accuser, who, when a sympathetic questioner appeared, became suddenly, and a little oddly, a defender.
"Let's hear what this vile enterprise was,"
Alan said, and, as always, was revolted to hear his voice boom out, dead and characterless.
"This may be a furor about nothing."
On the platform, Mrs. Birmingham peered distastefully down, seeking to identify the questioner. Then she read from the summary.
Miss J.E. did willingly in the bathtub of the community bathroom of her housing unit, this unit, copulate.
"I'd call that something,"
the voice said, and then the dogs were loose. The accusations fell thick and fast, a blur of lascivious racket. Beside Alan, his wife huddled against him. He could feel her dread, and he put his arm around her. In a while, the voice would be tearing at him. At 9:15, the faction vaguely defending Miss J.E. seemed to have gained an edge. After a conference, the Council of Block Wardens released the girl with an oral reprimand, and she slipped gratefully from the room. Mrs. Birmingham again arose with the agenda. With relief, Alan heard his own initials. He walked forward, listening to the charges, glad to get it over with. The juvenile, thank God, had reported about as expected.
"Mr. A.P.,"
Mrs. Birmingham declared,
"did on the night of October 7, 2114 at 11:30 p.m. arrive home in a drunken state, and did fall on the front steps of the housing unit, and in so doing utter a morally objectionable word."
Alan climbed the stage, and the session began. There was always the danger that somewhere in the room a citizen waited with a deeply buried quirk, a deposit of hate nourished and hoarded for just such an occasion as this. During the years that he had leased in this housing unit, Alan might easily have slighted some nameless soul. The human mind being what it was, he might have set off a tireless vengeance by stepping ahead in line, failing to nod, treading on foot, or the like. But as he looked around, he saw no special emotion. Nobody glowered demonically, and nobody, except for his stricken wife, even appeared interested. Considering the shallowness of the charge, he had good reason to feel optimistic. All in all, he was well off. Realizing this, he faced his composite accuser cheerfully.
"Mr. Purcell," it said, "you haven't been up before us in quite a spell,"
it corrected.
"Mr. A.P., I meant."
"Not for several years," he answered.
"How much had you had to drink?"
3 glasses of wine."
"And you were drunk on that?"
The voice answered itself.
"That's the indictment."
It haggled, and then a clear question emerged.
"Where did you get drunk?"
Not wishing to volunteer material, Alan kept his answer brief. "At Hokkaido." Mrs. Birmingham was aware of that, so evidently it didn't matter.
"What were you doing there?"
the voice asked, and then it said,
"That's not relevant. That has nothing to do with it. Stick to the facts. What he did before he was drunk doesn't matter.
To Alan, it sounded like Janet. He let it battle on.
Of course it matters. The importance of the act depends on the motives behind it. Did he mean to get drunk? Nobody means to get drunk. I'm sure I wouldn't know.
Alan said, "It was on an empty stomach, and I'm not used to liquor in any form."
What about the word he used? Yes, what about it? Well, we don't even know what it was. I think we're just as well off. Why, are you convinced he's the sort of man who would use words like that? All I mean is that knowing the particular word doesn't affect the situation.
And I was tired, Alan added. Years of work with media had taught him the shortest routes to the Morrick mind. Although it was Sunday, I had spent the day at the office. I suppose I did more than was good for my health, but I like to have my desk clear on Monday.
A regular little gentleman, the voice said.
It retorted at once.
With manners enough to keep personalities out of this. Bravo, it said. That's telling him. Probably her.
And then, from the chaos of minds, a sharp sentiment took shape. As nearly as Alan could tell, it was one person.
This a mockery is. Mr. Purcell is one of our most distinguished members. As most of us know, Mr. Purcell's agency supplies a good deal of material used by telemedia. Are we supposed to believe that a man involved in the maintenance of society's ethical standards is himself morally defective? What does that say about our society in general? This, a paradox, is. It is just such high-minded men, devoted to public service, who set by their own examples our standards of conduct.
Surprised, Alan peered across the room at his wife. Janet seemed bewildered, and the choice of words was not characteristic of her. Evidently, it was somebody else.
Mr. Purcell's family leased here several decades, the voice continued. Mr. Purcell was born here. During his lifetime, many persons have come and gone. Few of us have maintained a lease as long as he has. How many of us were here in this room before Mr. Purcell? Think that over. The purpose of these sessions is not the humbling of the mighty. Mr. Purcell isn't up there so we can deride and ridicule him. Some of us seem to imagine the more respectable a person is, the more reason to attack him. When we attack Mr. Purcell, we attack our better selves. And there's no percentage in that.
Alan felt embarrassed.
These meetings,
the voice went on,
operate on the idea that a man is morally responsible to his community. That's a good idea. But his community is also morally responsible to him. If it's going to ask him to come up and confess his sins, it's got to give him something in return. It's got to give him its respect and support. It should realize that having a citizen like Mr. Purcell up here is a privilege. Mr. Purcell's life is devoted to our welfare and the improvement of our society. If he wants to drink 3 glasses of wine once in his life and say 1 morally objectionable word, I think he should be allowed to. It's okay by me.
There was silence. The roomful of people was cowed by piety. Nobody dared speak. On the stage, Alan sat wishing somebody would attack. His embarrassment had become shame. The eulogizer was making a mistake. He didn't have the full picture.
"Wait a minute," Alan protested. "Let's get one thing straight. What I did was wrong. I haven't got any more right to get drunk and blaspheme than anybody else."
The voice said,
"Let's pass on to the next case. There doesn't seem to be anything here."
On the platform, the middle-aged ladies conferred and presently composed their verdict. Mrs. Birmingham arose.
"The block neighbors of Mr. A.P. take this opportunity to reprimand him for his conduct on the night of October 7, but feel that in view of his excellent prior record, no disciplinary action is indicated. You may step down, Mr. A.P.
Alan stepped down and rejoined his wife. Janet squeezed against him, wildly happy.
"Bless him. whoever he was.
I don't deserve it, Alan said, disturbed.
You do, of course you do.
Her eyes shone recklessly.
You're a wonderful person.
Not far off, at one of the tables, was a mild little elderly fellow with thinning gray hair and a formal, set smile. Mr. Wales glanced at Alan, then turned immediately away. That's the guy, Alan decided. Wales.
Are you sure?
The next accused was up on the stage, and Mrs. Birmingham began reading the indictment.
Mrs. R.M. did knowingly and willingly on the afternoon of October 9, 2114, in a public place and in the presence of both men and women, take the name of the Lord in vain.
The voice said,
What a waste of time!
And the controversy was on. After the meeting, Alan approached Wales. The man had lingered outside the door, as if expecting him. Alan had noticed him in the hall a few times, but he didn't recall ever having said more than good morning to him. That was you, Alan said. They shook hands.
I'm glad I could help you out, Mr. Purcell.
Wales' voice was drab, perfectly ordinary.
I saw you speak up for that girl. You always look out for the people up there. I said if he ever gets up, I'll do the same for him. We all like and respect you, Mr. Purcell.
Thanks, Alan said awkwardly. As he and Janet walked back upstairs, Janet said,
What's the matter?
She was in a delirium at having escaped from the meeting.
Why do you look so glum?
I feel glum, he said.